So chapter 8 takes us into issues of stimulus control over behavior. Now, I mean, we've been talking about this throughout the course. There, you know, we just haven't called it stimulus control, per se. So stimulus control is just like what should be happening in this room with respect to chatting to your friend in class. Right. So there should be some stimulus control here in the presence of the speaking instructor. Discriminative stimulus. Response of conversation will lead to public humiliation and embarrassment. Shame! Or just laughter at me, one or the other, whichever. We take what we can get. Okay. So, stimulus control is dealing with the idea of differential responding and stimulus discrimination. We've got complex environments, all right? You might have heard the expression separating the signal from the noise. A lot of stuff going on. Not all of it is important. There's a lot of background noise. And so the learning behavioral approach, study of stimulus control, is what is it that is going to be the signal? What's extracted from the noise? How does that control behavior? How does that regulate, influence behavior? So what is it that's actually important? What do you attend to? Reynolds did a classic study on this. I was one of the first that actually tried to do something, a compound stimulus from the very beginning. We talk in classical conditioning, you know, you train up a CS1, then you bring in a second CS, you get blocking, or you got a compound stimulus, you separate it, and you get conditional responding to both. In this case, he did an operant situation. So he trained pigeons to peck on a key light that had a red background with a yellow triangle. And then, in the test phase, he separated the stimuli such that the pigeons could either respond to the red circle or the white triangle. And what he found was a little bit surprising. There was no single stimulus that took precedent here between the pigeons. Individual pigeons would do this in different ways. So bird 107 here used the red circle. Bird 105 uses the white triangle. Other pigeons used, you know, one or the other. And this was more or less evenly split. So in this case, this is saying that different individuals will actually select different elements of the environment to exert or to gain the stimulus control. May not be getting, you know, if you were trying to set up a training process or whatnot, your subjects may not actually be responding to what you think they are responding to. What seems obvious to you may not at all be obvious to your subjects. Teachers encounter this very frequently. What seems to be a terribly important concept or idea or whatnot is much less likely to gain stimulus control than the cool car that just drove by, you know, outside the classroom. All right, so you can get into these sorts of issues. In terms of discrimination and generalization, then, if we've got differential responding, we've got stimulus discrimination. So if you're trained on a stimulus and you respond predominantly to that stimulus or stimuli that are more like it, you are discriminating. In other words, there is a differentiation of responses. To these stimuli, do not respond. To these stimuli, do. We've got differential responding. If we have a greater similarity of responding across stimuli, so if you've been trained to respond with a particular stimulus set, and if you respond, yes, to those stimuli, but also to a bunch of others, excuse me, we would say that you are generalizing. In other words, you are treating multiple stimuli as similar, as alike. Now, in the real world, sometimes we want discrimination. Other times, we actually want generalization. So, you know, if you're going to set up a applied training contingencies, you've got to think about what you're trying to get. All right? If you're trying to train life skills for people that have been institutionalized, you want them to be able to generalize those outside of the institution and into the real-world setting. Right? This becomes a trade-off. Right? I mean, initially, you need to try to get some discrimination. When is it appropriate to do a particular task, activity, response, behavior? But then you also need it, in these kinds of situations, to generalize outside of the kind of clinical setting. Therapists get this all the time, right? Trying to get their patients, if you focus in on particular stimuli or contexts or conditions that are relevant to the behavior, but then they also have to make sure that they can get their patients to be able to use the techniques they've learned here, the therapeutic techniques, outside of the therapist's office. So these become interesting challenges. The standard way to evaluate, at least within a laboratory context, generalization and discrimination, or more broadly, stimulus control, is to use what are called generalization gradients. So you train on one or more stimuli. You test then on a continuum, that is a gradient, of other related stimuli. So if we've been doing in the presence of the 500 hertz tone, if you respond, you get reinforced. Then we would try a variety of other tones and see how responding goes to them. Collect the data, plot it on the graph. That's your generalization gradient. Typical ways of doing this are to use either probe trials. So every now and then, you keep presenting the trained stimulus, make the response, get the outcome, and every now and then you toss in some novel stimulus. You want to see whether or not there's responding to that. So those are probe trials. You can also use extinction blocks. So you train up the response, and then you stop reinforcing anything. You present all the various stimuli in randomized blocks. You see how much responding there is to it. Then do another randomized block of all the stimuli, and so on, until the subject's completely extinguished. Collect up your data, plot it on the graph. Now, this actually gets a little bit tricky. One of the things, I mean, the reason that in both probe trials and extinction blocks, you've got to make sure, so in the probe trial, you don't reinforce the probe trial. So if it's like, 500 hertz tone, if you respond, you get reinforced. And then, every 15 or 20 times the 500 hertz tone is presented, you present a different tone, a 490 hertz tone one time, a 470 hertz, a 530 hertz. You got to make sure that on these probe trials, you don't, if the subject responds, it doesn't get reinforced. Because then all you're doing is now teaching the subject a new three-term contingency. Oh yeah, I learned if I respond in the presence of a 500 hertz tone, I get reinforced. Oh, but guess what? If I respond to that 490, I also get reinforced. And then pretty quickly, the subject is responding to everything. Now, what you're trying to find out is whether the 500 has gained stimulus control here. Whether or not the subject says, yeah, I'm only going to respond to the 500 or things that are really like it, or whether it will respond to everything. In other words, it's just generalizing. The extinction block technique gets around that by putting everything on extinction, so nothing gets reinforced at all. You got to make sure you randomize things, and you got to adjust your saliences and everything else there with this, but doing that, you don't have to worry about the reinforcement issue there. The probe trials, extinction blocks, the whole point of extinction blocks is you test until they do extinguish. That's sort of it. On the probe trials, one of the flips of this is you can't present a probe stimulus too often because you're not reinforcing it, but you don't want the subjects responding to the trained stimulus to extinguish. If you present a 500 hertz tone on trial 1 and then on trial 2, a 490, which doesn't get reinforced. On trial 3, a 500 hertz tone, respond, get reinforced. Trial 4, 530 hertz tone is a probe trial, no reinforcement. You're extinguishing every other response, right? That's really going to start reducing your overall level of responding. So you can only present these probe stimuli maybe every 15th, 20th response in there or trial in there. If you do it really much more frequently, you can get extinguishing of the actual trained-up response, which, again, compromises your results. What that means is using probe trials is slow. If you train on a stimulus and you want to test 8 other stimuli for your generalization gradient, and you want, I don't know, 50 samples for each of your 8 other stimuli, and you can only do it once every 20 reinforced trials, well, you're doing thousands of trials here. Now, with the rat in the cage, it's not like the rat's got anything better to do. But if you're doing something with human subjects, right, even if you're running one trial every 20 seconds, it's still hours of work on this. You're not going to get a lot of people that want to stick around for that. Then you get into fatigue issues and all kinds of other things. So, you know, that becomes a downside with the probe trials. They're more often used if you have a lot of data collect with the non-humans. Extinction blocks, you know, do less, actually less time in the, you know, the sample seat and the experimental seat, so you can actually more likely get people to do this. So we've got our data. You know, you get the fun part. You plot your data points on the graph, and you look at them, and you try to think what you see. I see a giraffe. Oh, no. I see a kind of mountainside sort of thing, silhouette of a mountain. All right? So there's your sort of typical generalization gradient. So stimuli, there's our training stimulus. So a lot of responding there to our training stimulus. For stimuli that are similar to our training stimulus, we see an awful lot of responding. But, so we got some generalization up at these 2 points. Then we've got discrimination for stimuli that are less like our training stimulus. Okay? In this case here, if we end up with something that's a fairly flat line, you've just got generalization. In other words, the subject treats everything the same as your training stimulus. Right? So wherever our actual dots were there. There's no distinction. Stimulus you're trained on, everything else, they're all about the same. Okay, so in that case, we don't have any discrimination at all. Discrimination and generalization are just flip sides of the same thing. If you've got a lot of discrimination, you've got little generalization. If you've got a lot of generalization, you've got very little discrimination. We've got a lot of generalization here. Yeah? Yeah, the question is, do they learn anything in this case? It depends on what you've done. There's a classic study that tested Lashley and Wade's theory, and it trained pigeons. One group of pigeons was raised in the presence of a tone. So in the presence of a tone, if you pecked, you got reinforced. In quiet periods of silence, if you pecked, you got nothing. Second group of pigeons, in the presence of a tone, if you peck, you get reinforced. And those pigeons were always in a tone. The tone was on 24/7 all through, you know, they hatch out of an egg. There you go. Now, as it turns out, for those pigeons, when you then do a discrimination test, present them with various other tones and periods of silence, they peck for everything. So they have learned peck in the presence of a tone, but they don't distinguish between any tones. Any noise is pecking time. So they've learned something, but they haven't learned, in terms of the stimulus control, they've learned a noise means respond, but they haven't learned the specifics of it. So you say, you know, you say, well, we're certainly not discriminating, but they are responding. So they've learned something. They've learned some sort of response pattern, at least. But it may not be what, you know, we were looking for. Or maybe this is what you want, actually. Maybe you do want complete generalization there. Spetch and Monlach in 93. This is Dr. Spetch here at the Department of Psychology. Senior faculty there. Really big name in comparative cognition and navigation and wayfinding. So 93... they had pigeons in a localization task. They were using touchscreen computers for this. So they basically put the pigeon in front of a touchscreen computer screen, and it pecks away at various parts of the screen. So instead of using little key lights or things like that, they're actually getting to sit in front of a computer screen in very much the same way that a human could do the same task in front of a computer screen and point at various things. I know nowadays everybody's got a touchscreen computer screen. You know, all your iPads are this way, you know, the eyeballs, everything. Back in 93, this was some pretty cool stuff, right? This was pretty elaborate. What the pigeons had to do was be able to peck at a target area that was a 2-centimeter square zone. If they managed to peck at this spot on the screen, and the spot on the screen was defined by an array of landmarks that would move around, but if they could get into that little 2-centimeter square zone, they got reinforced. Like I said, there's landmarks that would be around this 2-centimeter area that they had to aim for. And so they do the training on this, and then they're testing to see which landmarks are actually controlling the discrimination by manipulating. And bugger. Okay, what happened there? Okay, I'll have to... I thought I saved that the right way. Oh, I know. Okay. I'll go back and resave that. It works on the Mac. Okay. I'll turn that back into a JPEG and post that onto the website. Sorry about that. Basically, what they had was an array of I can describe it. I remember this. They had an array of four geometric shapes that would appear, and at a particular point inside that array of shapes, they would have this 2-centimeter square area, and they could move the entire array around on the screen, so you didn't always have to poke exactly the same place on the screen. You had to find the spot by using the landmarks, and then what they would do is they would take some of the landmarks away. So in the testing, they'd either test for all the landmarks there, or two of the landmarks there, or three of them, or one of them, and they'd see. So for different pigeons, it turns out, just like with our red circle, yellow triangle, red circle, white triangle, where pigeons used, you know, the different pigeons used the different stimuli, we get the same thing here. So when all of the landmarks are in, they go in the middle, and, you know, here we've only got one landmark, but this landmark, so landmark one alone, actually does a pretty good job of getting the pigeons to peck in a very localized area. Landmark two alone, not bad, but these little sort of, you know, this looks sort of like a mountain, okay? The taller it is, you know, the more concentrated the responding is there, you know, sort of top down. But you see these little other sort of black spots around there? Those are locations where the pigeon was pecking. We see a little bit of that with, you know, it's like way off. Occasionally, maybe just like one way off on the side peck there. I don't know what the pigeon was doing that time. But most of it's fairly concentrated. But consider here. So, I mean, landmark one and landmark two seem to be exerting the main stimulus control here in this pigeon. With landmark three, they're just pecking everywhere. It's all over the place. Landmark four, again, somewhat all over the place. And not really on center there. So here's a case where there's only one landmark absent. Landmark one is taken away. Landmark two is taken away, but the other three are there. So in any case where only one landmark is removed, they still do pretty good. This pigeon is doing quite well here. But when you start taking away three out of the four, we find that different landmarks have a different weighting. So not all of the landmarks were equal in terms of exerting stimulus control. In a different pigeon here, we get a different pattern. In this case here, in this pigeon, look, it's landmark three alone. It does pretty good. Look, it's right in the middle, very concentrated. You know, landmark one, it's off. It's a bit high and to the left, and there's a lot of pecks all over. Landmark two, I mean, it's just all over the place. Landmark four only, all over the place. So in this bird here, with landmark one taken away, does pretty good. Landmark two absent, yeah, no real problem. Landmark three absent, right? This doesn't look all that great. But notice over here, landmark three in this pigeon is really, really important. Right? In our previous pigeon, it seemed to be using primarily landmark one and landmark two. This one here is really going with landmark three. Okay? So you take landmark four away, it doesn't change it. It's still doing pretty well. So what this is showing is that individuals can have huge variation in what they are going to use as a controlling stimulus. And part of what I like about Dr. Spetch's work on this is some of the early work that beautifully demonstrated that your non-human lab subjects, in fact, are individuals. We tend to say, if you got a rat, you got a rat. They're all going to be more or less the same. Yeah, pigeon, pigeon, pigeon. But in some cases, they've got very unique, very distinct individual preferences. No idea why pigeon 271, who was raised in the same way as pigeon C207, preferred landmark 3 over landmarks 1 and 2. No clue. And we can't actually ask the pigeon, right? What's it going to say? Brrr. Pick, pick, pick. It doesn't give us a lot. You know? But if you ask humans even, it's like, well, why are you using these? You can't always get an answer either. I don't know. Just damn. It's like, well, that's... Can you be more explicit? No. Anything at all? Now, you know, you usually don't have to ask people this, but say, after accident reports in things like flying, right? Where you know, they're trying to find out why was the pilot missed the runway. You know, they're trying to, in part, things like, ever watch, you know, like air disasters on whatever it is, Discovery or something like this? Yeah, if you're about to go on a trip, highly recommend watching about 2 weeks of this. It's like, we're going to walk. Okay, anyways, so planes crash. But, you did, and, I mean, you know, they're not always doing it just to try to point blame at the pilot, but they're doing try to figure out what was it that was just, you know, what caused this. In some cases, I mean, it's just instrumentation overload. Why is it that one pilot isn't bothered by this, but others are? Different stimulus control, different things. One of those things actually that can get pilots to like just straight into the ground is losing the horizon. As humans, we seem to be stunningly primed to determine which way is up by looking at a horizontal line. Because most cases, right? I mean, you know, we got the horizon there to look at. You know, I'm standing up right there. There's the horizon. You know, if you're down on the ground, you wake up. It's like, yep. Yeah, it's going this way to me. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Okay. But if you get really foggy conditions or you're stuck in dense cloud and whatnot, what the pilots are trained to do, what they should do, is just use instrumentation. Okay. Just use the instrument, which will tell them which way the plane is angling. But really prone, a lot of pilots are really biologically predisposed. Look out the window. It's like, I don't see any land. I don't see any horizon. Plane starts spinning. Okay? Not everybody can gain the stimulus control. Some can. Some can just work off of instrumentation. Others can't. There's individual differences in pilots. Could be a perfectly good pilot unless they go into a cloud bank. Right? So, again, variation. We see the same thing in pigeons. Right? So, individual differences. Okay. So, what are some of the factors involved in stimulus control? Well, sensory capacity is a big one here. You can't have a stimulus that's going to gain control if you can't actually detect it. So, if you've got, I mean, listen carefully. Hold on, see if I can do this. Do you hear that? It was an ultrasonic screech. I was actually raised by bats, not humans, for the first 3 years of my life, and so I can actually make ultrasonic squeaks. But it's very useful for catching bugs. And I did do my PhD on water striders, which are insects. So it was very, very handy. But most humans can't detect that. On the other hand, actually, if there's any bats in the building, they're probably heading this way now. So if you have any phobic conditions, sorry. Okay. ultraviolet light. We can't see ultraviolet light. Honeybees can. From the point of view of a honeybee, you know, flowers look stunningly different. From their point of view, what we see of flowers, you know, so we see a flower here. Yeah, there's your flower. Ah, how pretty. For the honeybees, many flowers, especially those that are pollinated by bees, have things like ultraviolet only, you know, color patterns that are in the ultraviolet. It's like runway landing strips. Come here. Get there. Okay? We can't see it. Right? From the honeybee's point of view, it may not see the color of the flower. It sees the ultraviolet. Okay? So, or honeybees, a lot of insects, ants, bees, many of them, navigate entirely by ultraviolet light from the sun, which, again, we don't pick up at all. It burns us. We get a sunburn, but we can't see. So on a cloudy, you know, you say, oh, you can navigate by the sun. It's cloudy. I can't see this sun. The ant's doing just fine. Ultraviolet punches right through the cloud layer from the ant's point of view. It's like, yeah, there's Mr. Sun. Doing good. Okay? So, again, different species utilize different things. Different individuals will have different sensory capacities as well. As well, of course, physical orientation, right? I mean, a stimulus behind my head, a visual stimulus behind my head, not very useful. Okay? Did you see that? What? My son was terribly distraught the other day. My son was terribly distraught the other day when I did not see the deer going down the front street. There was no deer. Okay. I'm quite certain. I'd be very surprised if a deer was really going down the front front street because I was sitting on the front step. I'm pretty sure I would have. But let's even imagine there was a deer going down the front street at that time. You know, and he couldn't understand how I could, you know, let's even pretend it was actually there. How could I have missed it? Well, because I wasn't looking at the street at the time. Right? But from Elliot's point of view, well, he saw it. Why didn't you? Because my back was turned. No eyes in the back of the head. But, you know, of course, I seem to know what he's doing wrong when he's doing it, even if he's behind me. That's a dad sense. Okay. So, you know, physical orientation is going to be important here as well. Now, we've talked about overshadowing in terms of classical conditioning. And, you know, really, although we didn't call it a stimulus control issue back in classical conditioning, that's what we're dealing with here. It's an issue of stimulus control. It's competition between stimuli for access to learning, to access to the associative strength. Generally speaking, until you go to too high of an intensity, generally speaking, a higher intensity stimulus is going to be more easily conditioned. It will condition more rapidly. It will overshadow less salient stimuli. Now, again, depending on the individual, some stimuli may be much more salient than others. All right, so again, it helps to know something about that. Now, we do get some interesting issues with respect to overshadowing. So we can talk about what's called the stimulus element approach. This one says that when you've got elements in a compound stimulus, they may be treated as distinct and separate components. Okay, so you can get into the overshadowing there. So if you treat a stimulus, a compound stimulus, multiple stimuli together, as individual pieces, then sure, whatever the most salient is, that's probably going to overshadow to some degree the others. However, it's also what's called the configural cue approach. And there's evidence supporting both of these. This one says, you know, the whole stimulus just gets treated as an integral whole. Right? So your textbook, you know, textbook gives the classic example that everyone gives, right? You know, you hear a symphony and, you know, can you pick out the third violin? It's like, oh yeah, the third violinist was really good. And let's not forget the fifth flautist. Oh, it was excellent there. Right? You just hear the whole sound, more or less. Yeah.
But aren't people who are, you know, like if you were in a symphony and you played an instrument or something, like at a high level, couldn't you listen to another symphony and pick out like the third violin?
Yeah, you might be able to.
Oh.
I don't know either. Yeah, I'm saying you might be able to, but it's meant to be produced as a gestalt. And this is probably what makes composers, good composers, so interesting, is they can take and treat things as individual elements and then put it into something that will be treated as a whole. So, you know, their score is all very complicated. Anyone done conducting and music conducting? Trying to read conductor's scores, it's just like, oh, good gods. That's like, a sensory overload. But it makes perfect sense to them for what they're doing there. But they've got to treat everything separately and then bring it back together. So there's probably some very interesting psychology to be done on musicians, composers, conductors with respect to this. And again, in some cases, it seems that in some cases we have a stimulus element approach being followed, and in others we have a configural cue approach being followed. In the case of configural cue, we can get overshadowing occurring, but it just tends to be in what we call a generalization decrement. It's just an overall loss of individual stimulus control there. In this case, the whole overshadows the individuals. So you treat all of it as sort of the same. Here's some data. So we've got an overshadowing group and a control group. The overshadowing group was presented with a weak stimulus and a strong stimulus. I'm trying to indicate this by smaller letters for weak and larger letters, capital, for strong. And then presented in the test with the weak stimulus. And what they find there is there's a decrement in terms of responding to the weak stimulus. In the control group, they were only presented with the weak stimulus and tested on the weak, and no decrement, no difference between training and test performance. Looking at this from a configural cue interpretation, this would say that the overshadowing then is due to the degree of generalization decrement from training to testing. In the case of the overshadowing group, what we've got here is something different. You weren't trained on weak and strong. You were trained on weak strong. Right? You were trained on this Gestaltian sort of whole. And as such, you're only getting a tiny little bit. Therefore, you shouldn't see any generalization decrement for the control group. So our overshadowing group learned the two, but only tested on the weak, so we do get quite a bit of generalization decrement in that case. Now, of course, if you take a stimulus elemental approach, there's going to be a different reason that you'd say, well, in that case, the strong was just much more salient, so you only attended to that. But, so both these interpretations, stimulus element, configural cue, they can both, you know, account for the same data there. So we've got evidence for both of these. Traditionally, classical conditioning has tended to ascribe to a stimulus element interpretation for stimulus control. It's a more traditional approach to things. Okay, we can also talk about types of reinforcement as something that may come into stimulus control. Definitely biological predispositions, right? Belongingness, we've talked about this throughout the term here. There may be different species issues. In some cases, you know, in the presence of this stimulus, you make this response, you get this outcome. In some cases, you just don't get any responding. The stimulus doesn't come to exert control over the response to produce a response to get the outcome there. Some species just don't respond to some stimuli. You can't hear ultrasound. Doesn't matter how great the reinforcer, you know, type might be there. You just can't get it in some cases in terms of stimulus. We talked about that. In other cases, no matter how great, you know, so flip-siding it here, you know, so from point of view, you can't hear the ultrasonic stimulus. So even if it was an ultrasonic stimulus leading to chocolate cake, you know, you couldn't hear that. The bat could. The bat would go, woohoo! Oh, it's cake. Couldn't it be a bug cake? Cricket cake? You got any crickets? From the bat's point of view, it hears the stimulus, and it's got bugs. Or it wants bugs. It gets chocolate. That's not much good for a bat. Except for the rare, you know, Parisian confectionery bat, which is, you don't see it very often. In this case here, in that case, the reinforcer is like, don't actually need that. Won't be attending to it. Thank you very much. So we got species differences. In other cases, we get some very interesting seasonal issues with respect to reinforcers. So even within a stimulus, within a species, for example, stimuli that are associated with courtship. So, you know, for a species, courtship, mating, pretty important, but for many species, only during mating season. Okay? If you're outside of mating season, you present a male with a receptive female, it's like, it's not mating season. What? It's not going to be a reinforcer. You're not going to gain stimulus control. Only during the mating season does this become an option. So, in that case, same species, but different times of years. So, seasonal effects. Okay? So, we get some very interesting things there, too. Force and Lordo demonstrated this rather nicely in the laboratory. Had a in training, group one, they would either get the... So they had a compound light tone stimulus. In the presence of the light tone lightened tone stimulus, if you press the pedal, you get food. In the second group, in the presence of the light tone stimulus, if you press the pedal, you avoid getting a shock. Okay, straightforward here. Then they tested the compound stimulus and the two individual components. So for group one here, what they find is that, so the red is the compound, okay, so responds, so in the presence of tone and light, yep, responds to get food. In the presence of light, responds to get food. In the presence of just tone, doesn't respond very much. Oh, so these are pigeons. Lordo liked pigeons, so he's working with pigeons. From this point of view, this makes a certain amount of sense. Pigeons find food visually, right? I mean, grain, you know, some seeds on the ground. Wait, I hear seeds. Yeah, what does it sound like exactly? It's kind of a slight rushly sound as the wind blows them around. Oh, okay. Right, okay, so I mean, they do most of their food gathering behavior visually. From that point of view, belongingness makes a lot of sense that this stimulus goes with the food reinforcer. In the case of the shock avoidance, though, it's something very different. Tone and light, sure enough, they can attend to that. They can detect that. They respond very strongly there. In the presence of tone and light, press the pedal. Try not to get a shock. However, in this case, the tone has a much greater stimulus control here than compared to our food group. Notice that the light is not as weak in terms of stimulus control. Both tone and light are responded to. Tone is definitely responded to more strongly. But again, this fits with pigeon biology too. They rely on a lot of auditory cues for predators. So if they're sitting there eating or something, they hear something coming up behind them or from below them or whatnot, above them. If they're flying, pigeons will execute a particular kind of escape behavior, wing movement, which puts them into a dive or tailspin or something like that to try to throw off the attacker. They can also use visual cues, though, as well. So even if it's, they could see something coming towards them to try to eat them. So in both cases here, although they seem to rely more on tone for avoiding predation, and this transfers very nicely to the shock avoidance response, we've got both here. But in the case of the food, the auditory stimuli, really not very controlling here at all. There's also instrumental response factors. The nature of the response that's going to be required to get the reinforcement can also affect the stimulus control. So we've got all the stimulus, outcome, response. Dobrzecka, Sejwezkowska, and Konorski in 66 did this. So This is trying to show behind and in front. So the so up here in our group one, metronomes in the front, buzzers behind. In training, and so if they hear the buzzer, they need to raise their front left leg. If they hear the metronome, they need to raise their right leg. Then they test, and so they move the metronome behind and they put the buzzer out front. So in this case, when they hear the metronome, what they actually do is raise the left leg. They should have raised the right leg. That was training. They raise the left. And they hear the buzzer, which is now moved out in front of them. They raise the right leg. This case here, in terms of behind and in front, with respect to left and right, they're not attending to the different stimulus here in terms of the different sound controlling it. They're using front or back with left and right. So a stimulus to your front goes with, in this case here, whatever is to the some sound in front of you means raise the right leg. Well, the buzzer is now in front of you, raise the right leg. Okay, so front, back, left, right. That seems to make a certain amount of sense. They're both directional components. It doesn't matter what the particular stimulus is. Okay, it's a directionality, orientation. In the group two, in this case, they've got what they call a go-no-go discrimination. So buzzer is located to the rear, metronome to the front. If you hear the buzzer, you need to lift the leg. If you hear the metronome, you need to leave the leg on the floor. Don't pick your foot up. Okay? Now, in this case, so we've got the buzzer behind, metronome to the front. In testing, they flip them around. Metronome comes to the back, buzzer goes to the front. And now when they hear the metronome, again, just like in training, in this case, they do not raise the leg. In this case, the location, front or back, was not what was being encoded, but actually the response. So the response goes with the actual auditory stimulus, not the location. In this case, we've got something else going on. So stimulus control issues can be very, very complicated. Right? We've got a lot of things coming into play here. There's learning factors as well. And different researchers over the years have had different interpretations of this. I mean, Pavlov, physiologist, medical physiologist. So Pavlov saw everything in terms of learning, in terms of a physiological, neurological structure. So he just saw differences between species in terms of stimulus control as being these inherent properties of the different species' nervous systems. He saw it as being a very innate process. He would talk about there being excitatory and inhibitory areas in the brain, regions of the brain. And he meant that quite literally. There is a specific excitatory region in your brain that goes with, say, a 500 hertz tone. So if you are trained on this 500 hertz tone, okay, that will strengthen your excitatory part of the brain for the 500 hertz tone. Then if you are presented with a 450 hertz tone, you are physically going to be activating, or pardon me, you are going to be activating a physically more proximate part of the brain to that 500 hertz tone section than if you present a 100 hertz tone. So the trained on 500, 400 or 450 is just literally going to be closer to the 500 area of the brain than a 100 hertz tone. Hence, of course, you would generalize more to the 450 or 400 hertz tone than the 100 hertz tone. Very nice interpretation if you are an engineer designing the system from scratch. Sadly, it doesn't work like that at all. Now, I mean, to be fair to Pavlov, I mean, you know, didn't have a lot of actually good neurological evidence to work on at that time. I mean, he did know different parts of the brain seem to do different things because people that would have, you know, brain damage in different areas would lose certain abilities. And so it seemed logical. It was just wrong. Our brain doesn't actually quite work the way thought it did. Okay? So he figured just the physical similarity of the stimuli were what were going to be really most important because of activating proximate or distal parts of the nervous system. Lashley and Wade took a very different approach. And I should say, Pavlov's interpretation was very predominant through the first, about three decades of the 20th century here. Neuroscience started getting better. It's like, well, we got a few problems with this. Lashley and Wade took a very different approach here. They said, and this was the one I was talking about earlier here, with the pigeons trained with either with always raised with the noise stimulus, they said explicit discrimination training is required. You can't have stimulus control unless you've actually had the opportunity to learn something about the stimuli that are actually controlling it. Okay, so stimulus control is going to be learned. It's not going to be inherently due to a species' nervous system structure. They argue that stimulus generalization will then occur because there's perhaps been a lack of learning about the differences between stimuli. So you, in fact, have not learned the difference. One way of, we can demonstrate this quickly is we either use classical or instrument. That's onto a different thing. I was saying, a classic study that was Jenkins and Reynolds in 67, maybe, did this was tried raising one group of pigeons in case where if you hear a tone, you peck, you get reinforced. If you hear a quiet period, you peck, you get nothing. In the other case, you would have the pigeons raised entirely. It's always a tone going, so it's never quiet. In the presence of the tone, you peck, you get reinforced. Then present other stimuli. In the case of the group 1 pigeons that had the presence-absence, they learned discrimination very nicely. They have had experience with sometimes you can get reinforced, sometimes you can't. The other pigeons, they don't learn this, so they generalize entirely. They can always get reinforced. Other studies to look at this, some of the first studies to try to do Lashley and Wade's approach here, we talked about these in 281, were things like just raise baby chicks entirely in the dark and then test them on color. And so they hatch out of the egg in the dark, they grow up in the dark, and then you put them into a testing situation where in the presence of green, if you respond, you get reinforced, but in other different color, you don't. And in those cases, they it seems to support Lashley and Wade. It's like, yeah, you know what? They're raised in the dark. If they've had no experience with color, they can't actually learn the color. They can't discriminate. They haven't learned it. But, just a second. But there's a problem in that, it was found out, they probably have a nervous system deficiency. Is that where it is? Yeah. So by raising them entirely in the dark, they miss a critical period, and their nervous systems just aren't structured to deal with the differences in color. So there were problems there with the early ones. So whereas the other study gets around that, there's no deficiency of noise. It's not like they're raised entirely in silence, and which may have damaged their auditory cortex. So in this case, they've always got some noise going on, allows the auditory cortex to develop, but they can't distinguish between a presence-absence situation. So there's some evidence that supports Lashley and Wade's interpretation here. All right. What might stimulus discrimination actually look like in terms of some data? Well, might look sort of like this. So we could either be doing classical or operant here. If we were doing an operant situation here, so in the presence of the green light, if you respond, you will get reinforced. And so these little on your cumulative record indicate reinforcements. Respond, 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 get reinforced. In the presence of the red light, or S minus, you will not get reinforced, and so response rate drops off, comes back to green, response rate picks up, drops off, picks up. Okay, so this would be, in terms of training this, we could even imagine that we've just started here, with an untrained subject, and we just go through this here. This is called presence-absence training. Presence of one stimulus, you do something, something's going to happen. Presence of another stimulus, you do something, something else is going to happen. Now, in terms of assessing how much control your training procedure has acquired, that's where we go back to the generalization gradients. Okay, so you utilize a generalization gradient after the fact. You do your training, then use probe trials or extinction blocks to find out what has happened. So that's one thing. We use the generalization gradient, but you also need to actually do a bit more work there. You know, for example, we talked about issues of is this actually a biologically relevant stimulus? It's like, woohoo, I get complete generalization. It's like, yeah, that's because perhaps they can't actually detect that stimulus. Oh, right. Once again, this is why we so commonly use rats, pigeons, mice, and gerbils in the lab nowadays, because there have been thousands and thousands of studies done with them. And if you want to go, I wonder if the pigeon can see, you know, a 40-watt green light, like, go look in the literature. You'll be able to find out. I wonder if a reticulated python can see a 40-watt green light. Go look in the... No literature on that. Okay, time to do a perceptual study first. Before you can get to the stimulus control, what does the reticulated python actually see? I got no idea. Couldn't tell you. I know they do a certain amount of their hunting by heat, but not sure what their color... color perception is. So you have to find out. Now, this is a rather classic study on this, the Jenkins and Harrison study from 62. Very nice. They had three groups here. So they're using their generalization gradient to assess stimulus control. Group one was trained on a 1,000 hertz tone. And their S minus was, well, their S minus was nothing, really. It was just silence. Okay. And so when they test on generalization gradient here, yeah, we get, you know, nice amount of responding here to our S plus. And look, we've got some discrimination. Well, we've also got a reasonable amount of generalization here, right? Compare that to our group 2 that had an S plus of 1,000 hertz tone and an S minus of a 950 hertz tone. This is a much narrower generalization gradient, right? I mean, anything beyond about, what's that look like, 1,200 hertz? They just didn't respond to it all. Anything below, I don't know, whatever that is, 900 and... Let's see, so 700 would probably be about here. So, we're on a scale. Maybe 850 they don't respond to. A very narrow discrimination curve here. It's like respond to things that are really like your S+. And the third group was a control here, no discrimination training at all. So they give them no training, and it's just like, hey, here's some tones. What you going to do? Well, I guess I'll just respond more or less to everything. So our circles and the dots here. Statistically, it's a flat line. Okay, statistically, they just... It's like, I don't know what's going on. I'm going to press the lever. Right? So we've got massive generalization. Moderate generalization, very, very little generalization. Okay. Lots of studies, both in classical and operant conditioning, have been done with this. So it's been demonstrated. And again, this works against Pavlov's account, saying this is going to be something that's very species-specific, biological. I mean, there's been studies that have used music, auditory frequencies, painting styles, geometric shapes, lights, tactile sensations, pictures of dead presidents, you name it, to do this. And they're able to train up stimulus control in these. So, you know, wide range of stimuli can come to exert stimulus control there. Another benefit of these, you know, various studies that are out there is they actually help us. You know, if you're more broadly interested in sort of a comparative cognition approach to things as opposed to a comparative psychology approach, this, you know, these varied stimuli help researchers learn a bit more about the actual sensory capacities of the different species that are, you know, might be of interest to you. I mentioned art styles. Watanabe and colleagues in 95 did something. I swear, sometimes, you know, sometimes psychologists just do things with a sort of a what the hell kind of attitude. Why not? Skinner certainly did some of this stuff. Well, he was doing it Skinner was doing the stuff he did to make a point. So he'd do things where he'd shape pigeons and it would look like they could actually read. Or he'd shape them to, like, what do you call, play ping pong. And it's like, isn't that amazing? Pigeons can do ping pong. And it's just stimulus control. It's all about stimulus control. Yeah. You thought you had free will? Thought you wanted to play ping pong? Oh, no. You've been conditioned. Skinner liked pointing out to people just how susceptible they were to conditioning in their daily existence. I don't know that he was always the life of the party, but yeah, you thought you wanted to come to this party. You really couldn't help yourself. But I have free will. Nuh-uh. So, yeah, you know. Must have had some interesting fights with the philosophers at Harvard. But anyway, so Watanabe and colleagues say, hey, let's see if pigeons can tell the difference between paintings by Monet and paintings by Picasso. So they just set up a discrimination training task. So here's some paintings by Monet. Here's some paintings by Picasso. Can they learn to be art critics? Now, if it was Skinner doing this, I'd swear he was doing it to point out that art critics actually aren't anything special. They've just been conditioned in terms of likes and dislikes. With Watanabe, it may just have been, we got a bunch of, like, digital pictures of paintings lying around. You know, let's just use those. What the heck? Not really sure. Anyways, the pigeons have here's some data on the pigeons there. Very high degree of accuracy there. They're able to distinguish between Monets and Picassos through a stimulus control process. And in fact, actually, they then are able to generalize to other artists of the same genre or style. So other impressionists and cubists. So seeing other Rodins or whatnot, other impressionists, they can go, that's different from other more cubist painters, styles. So it generalizes as well. Again, you know, the pigeons don't know anything about art. It's just an issue of stimulus control. Okay. Now, in terms of what's actually being learned, Spence has this beautiful opponent process theory, first published in 1936. In case you care about the date. You don't have to. It's not really important here. But Spence argued that in stimulus control, what's happening is the subject is learning about both. Spence worked primarily in operant conditioning. So he talked about discriminative stimuli. So S pluses and S minuses. But you could apply this to a classical conditioning framework as well. Okay. But it works. You can apply this to stimulus control for classical conditioning, but we'll just stick with the instrumental side for now here. But if you like classical, by all means, translate. Every time CNS plus, put CS plus. Every time CNS minus, put CS minus. So he said, your subjects don't learn just about a stimulus. They learn about both, assuming that they actually are there, an S plus and an S minus. And he said they treat these stimuli separately. Somehow their nervous system processes these as individual separate components. He said your S plus comes to represent excitation, neuronal excitation, excitation in the brain somehow. And your S plus is representing an inhibitory system. So in essence, we've seen opponent process models before. This is an opponent process system. Your S plus generates neuronal excitation. S minus generates neuronal inhibition. Bring them together, add them together, what do you get? If there's more excitation than inhibition, you respond. If there's more inhibition than excitation, you don't respond at all. So during the acquisition period, so this is what you're acquiring. You're learning about the S plus and the S minus. You're learning about what is going to be excitatory or inhibitory. Given that, then, he says, if you've generated an excitatory gradient inside your brain there associated with an S+, then you will expect to see more excitation and hence more responding for stimuli that are more similar to the S+. If you have an inhibitory stimulus, S-, it will generate an inhibitory gradient inside your brain there. Stimuli that are more similar to the S- will have very little responding. The more dissimilar you are to the S-, the more you will respond. So we get some data by Honig from 1963. Very nice study here. First group of pigeons are trained. These are represent key lights, so little buttons on the wall with backlit and that the pigeons can peck at. Honig liked pigeons. He always worked with pigeons. Given the choice, he would work with pigeons. Heard him at a conference once. Did I mention that Bandura is going to be here on Thursday? Bandura of, like, Bahu? Bobo the doll? The Bobo punching the crap out of Bobo the clown? Yeah, he's going to be here on Thursday. He's speaking. He's going to talk at 7:30. If you go by the psych office, they've got tickets. I don't know exactly what the tickets cost, but you can, if you're interested in seeing Bandura, came from Mundare, I think. Is that close to Vegreville? Yeah. Yes, that's right. Albertan boy made good, you know. A lot of videos about him on YouTube with clowns being beaten up and stuff like that. So, anyways, he'll be here on Thursday. He's getting an honorary degree at the convocation. So, anyways. I just thought about that because Honig's dead. So he's passed away now. There's not that many people left who, you know, were contemporaries of people like Skinner and sort of generation after Skinner there, but no one there. So. Anyways, getting back to this. What we find here, group one, trained to respond, S+ is a key light that's got a vertical black bar. S- is just a blank key light. So respond if you see a black bar, a vertical black bar, don't respond if you see nothing. Okay? These are the testing stimuli. Notice there is no S-. There is no blank key that they are presented with. They are presented with some horizontal lines. Some lines are a little bit off horizontal, diagonal 45 to the vertical, and then down in the other direction. But they never get shown the S-. So what do we find here? We get maximum responding to the S+, well, no surprise, and we get minimal responding, you know, mean total responses, so over, you know, 100 here, to, well, not the S-, because we don't have the S-, but to the horizontal bar. The thing that out of the stimuli that you've got is least like the vertical. So having no bar at all would be least like a vertical black bar. Having a horizontal bar is, well, out of the choices, the least like the S+. So we get a lot of excitation, according to Spence, to the S+, hence we get a lot of responding. We get progressively less excitation for stimuli that are less and less and less like the S+. Now, in this case, we never have no responding. We're still over, you know, 100 and, what's it, looks about 140, 130 responses there. We still get responding because it's not the S-. It's still a bar, right? And having a bar is more like having a vertical bar than having no bar at all. Second group. So this fit. I mean, well, yeah, it's a pretty, okay, it's a generalization gradient, yippee, what's so exciting about that? Nothing really. I mean, that's what you kind of expect. It's the second group that's kind of cool. And this one here, the S+ is a blank key light. The S- is the vertical bar. Take a look. Again, there is no, you know, nothing up my sleeve, nothing on the screen. There is no blank key light. These pigeons in group two are not tested on the S+. Right. There's the S-, and look, very little responding to that. And as we go here, we get, well, We never get the S plus, but a horizontal bar is the least like the S minus, so we get the most responding to the horizontals. Still nowhere near the kind of responding you would have gotten to the S plus if it were there, but it's the most not like the S minus. And that looks like Spence's inhibitory curve in the presence of the S minus. Lots of inhibition. As you get less similar to the S minus, there is less inhibition. Hence, you respond more. As you get even further, even more dissimilar to the S minus, even less inhibition, responding, and so on. So, Spence's theory becomes rather important because we actually find there's a great deal of interaction between S pluses and S minuses. This occurs especially if you're using what we call intradimensional discrimination. So discrimination within the same dimension, be it different forms of geometric shapes or different tones or different auditory frequencies, whatnot. In that case, right, you're doing all the same thing with the same stimulus continuum, so you're going to get an interesting interaction. And what we find there is this weird, wacky little thing called peak shift. Now, we've already seen peak shift, actually. I showed you this graph a few slides back. I didn't talk about it then. Did it on purpose, right? Take a look here at our group two. The maximum amount of responding, the peak level of responding, is actually, this isn't like a screw-up. They didn't misprint this or something, right? There's the amount of responding to the S+, and look, there's more responding to a stimulus that's not the S+. Weird, huh? Whoa. It's not tripping you out? Apparently you're also blasé about this stuff. It's like, yeah, I've seen weirder. Okay, fine. It's a lot to shock you guys, doesn't it? This was pretty shocking, actually, at the time. It was, I mean, back, this had been known for a while, but in the 30s, people start going, wait a second. Now, this is where Spence's interpretation actually becomes really important, because it does a beautiful job of explaining it. So, with your peak shift, you get your maximum responding on a generalization gradient, not to the training stimulus. You only see this if you have presence-absence training with an S plus and an S minus in the same stimulus continuum. Okay. So as I said, we see this in the Jenkins and Harrison. Now, we don't get it in our first group here, right? And then you say, well, where's the peak shift there, Snyder? Well, look, your S plus is a tone, your S minus is just silence. Isn't that sort of the same stimulus continuum? Yeah, really. Not exactly. Silence is really pretty different from a 1,000 hertz tone. Whereas, we take a look here, we've got a 1,000 hertz tone versus a 950. It's definitely both tones. Okay, so definitely the same stimulus continuum. And over here for a poor group three, that's just blah, 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 no idea what's going on. I'm just going to press a bit. Woohoo! Okay, well, we got no peak shift at all because they're not discriminating at all here. Hansen did, oh, I forgot in bracket there, close bracket. You know, we see this here with Hansen. So this case here, there's our S plus, oh, sorry, our S plus for all of these is a 550 wavelength light. Our S minus in group one with the circles is 555 nanometers, so it'll be right here. The second group with an S minus, the squares, has an S minus of 590, somewhere over here. And again, we get a shift. Our control group, just the S plus, in that case with just the S plus, we get maximal responding at the S plus. Okay? So we're only seeing this when we get into presence-absence training with S pluses, S minuses in the same stimulus continuum. Okay, there's where we get the peak shift. So there's our shift. We've moved away from our S plus in a direction opposite to the S minus. Okay. Now, here's how Spence interprets this. We've seen opponent processes before, as I said. It says, your S plus generates an internal excitatory gradient. There's excitation going on somewhere in the brain. Now, unlike Pavlov, Pavlov said, you know, you're getting a CS, the CS plus activates the, you know, a CS plus for a 500 hertz tone activates the chunk of brain that deals with 500 hertz tones in an excitatory manner. There will be another chunk of brain that does 500 hertz tone in an inhibitory manner. Right? Spence isn't saying that. He's not saying, I'm not saying it's anywhere in a particular in the brain. It's just somehow there's excitation in the brain. Something excitatory is generated. There we go. Okay. The S minus then generates an inhibitory gradient. The actual generalization gradient, that is the actual behavior that you have measured through your discrimination testing, that's due to the net sum effect of excitation and inhibition. The underlying excitatory and inhibitory gradients that are stuck there in your head someplace, rattling around in there. Okay, so it's the output of both of them. If all you got is an inhibitory gradient, you will see no, you will get no responding, at least according to this. Well, the question is, is there a neurological basis? I mean, it depends how you want to look at it. If you look at it this way, I mean, we have excitatory neurotransmitters and inhibitory neurotransmitters. The more inhibitory synapsing we've got there, the less likely your neurons are to trip over a threshold, and then you won't get a signal. So in that sense, it's not an unreasonable approach to take. By this point in the 30s, Spence was at least there. Neurology was getting better, neurophysiology is getting better, Spence is at least cognizant enough to go, I'm not exactly sure how, you know, I mean, we know there's differences in neurons, but I'm not comfortable about saying it's this chunk of brain right here. So he doesn't say that. So, I mean, this could be happening down at very small neural network levels. You could probably model this very nicely with an artificial neural network computer program to do this. You know, picture your textbook here. So here's our excitatory gradient, and it's centered on something maybe I didn't make clear, maybe I didn't. Your gradients are going to be centered on your stimuli. So your excitatory gradient will be centered on your S plus, your inhibitory gradient will be centered on your S minus. And then the actual down here, the net excitatory strength then will come from adding these up, like literally adding them together. So positive values for excitation, negative values for inhibition. And so in this case here, notice what we get. Here's our S plus, here's our S minus. Okay, so if you wanted to take the times, we've got like about 70 units of excitation there and about, what's that, maybe 35 or so units of inhibition at the S plus. So the S plus generates about 35 units of net excitatory strength. But if we move a little bit over here, we've got like about 60 units of excitation and maybe, what's that, about minus 10 units of inhibition. So at the 480 wavelength, so 60 minus 10 is about 40-ish. Maybe it's a little over 60 over here. So that's where we actually get our maximum responding. Our peak has shifted. Right? Now, the other thing to notice here is see how it sort of drops off rather quickly on this side, you know, closer to the S minus. So we get a, I can never remember if this is skew or kurtosis or whatnot, but we get a bias on the side of this. We get this, you know, long sort of tail that dangles off onto this side over here. That's because there's a lot of inhibition going on. There's still some excitation as well, but it's going to knock it down there rather more quickly. So it's the net sum effect. Here's another sort of view of this, my way of doing this. Did it my way. So let's say we've got some excitation centered on an S plus here. We'll always use the same excitation. So this is just much more of a conceptual sort of view of this. So let's say that we had had a group here that has an inhibitory stimulus there. So there's our S pluses, there's our S minus, during training, and then we're going to go do some old tests in there, the actual generalization gradient, the net sum, and we might get something that looks sort of like this. We get a peak shift, right? So we shift over in this direction. What if we had them, same, we'll have another group that's got our S plus, same S plus, but it's got a different S minus over on this side. Well, we should get a peak shift going in that direction. Okay? And if we had something like this, so S plus, and then here's our S minus, way the heck over here, we get this. Now, in this case, the S plus and the S minus don't actually overlap. They are so dissimilar. They're on the same stimulus continuum, but they're just so different that, net sum effect here. Well, we still got some excitation here, some excitation here. There we go. The inhibition doesn't start until over here. Oh, there's no inhibitory effect from this. In that case, if they're that far apart, you're not going to see a peak shift. Now, in fact, I don't think I drew one of these in. I did it in a slightly different way here. What if you had this situation, same S plus, but you got now two S minuses, one on either side? I know this is looking a bit like a dog's breakfast now. Sorry about that. It's a bit messy. But if you've got this case with the fuchsias now, we'll just have a very narrow generalization gradient centered on the S plus, right? If you will, this inhibitory gradient takes out this tail or this side of the excitation. This one here takes out sort of this side of the excitation, but neither of them actually does anything with respect to knocking down the excitation in the middle. So in this case, we get a very narrow gradient centered on the S plus. Okay. So this would be essentially how Spence's theory would account for this. And it does a pretty good job. I mean, empirical data seems to support this quite nicely. Any questions about that? Good. Okay, cool. wow, motoring through this today. Okay, so we can talk about absolute and relative stimulus control. Basically, absolute control means, in terms of stimulus control, means you learn about the absolute properties of the stimulus, whatever they happen to be. Relative learns means you learn a relationship. So it is exactly a 523.9 hertz tone. Well, okay, that's kind of silly, but it's a 590 hertz tone. It sounds like this, all right? A relational stimulus control will be, it's louder than the other one, or it's bigger than the other one, or it's wetter than the other one, whatever it happens to be. So a relationship. Now, Spence's theory is in this absolute camp. Okay, Spence's theory fits into the absolute. You're learning these generalization, excitatory, inhibitory generalization gradients then are pertaining to a very specific S plus and S minus. Spence's interpretation does not do particularly well if you have to do a relational sort of understanding, and then it has a few more problems. Anyways, one of the ways of testing whether or not you've got a absolute or relational type of learning is to use Kohler's transposition task. Kohler was the guy that got stuck in Malta for 5 years when World War I broke out, working with chimpanzees. So he'd be the guy that would hang a banana from the ceiling, give the chimps some boxes, see if they could, through intuition, figure out how to stack them up and get to the banana. Or there's some fruit outside the chimp's cage. Here's a couple of sticks that slot together. Could they figure out a way of getting the fruit? So he meant to go for 6 months. War breaks out. He gets stuck there for 5 years. After he was actually a German spy as well. He was reporting on British shipping past Malta. Anyways, but after he got back to Germany after the war, he swore he'd never work with chimps again. He was so tired of working with chimpanzees. Only meant to go for 6 months and work with them, and then he had to just start. It's like, well, what the hell do I do now? I got some boxes, and I got some fruit, and I got a chimp. Okay. Experiment. Go. Anyways, so he gets back. He works with chickens and ravens at that point. So he did manage to get his transposition task stuff published. He didn't publish really frequently. When he did publish, it was some really significant stuff. Sadly, he was years ahead of his time. You ever heard of, like, Alex the Great Parrot? He's dead now. But in terms of spectacular cognitive abilities, ability to count zero, zero knowledge, tool use, all kinds of things. More recently, there's been some, even in the sort of popular media, Caledonia crows and their use of tools to manipulate things to get reinforcers and whatnot. This is kind of stuff that Kohler was doing through a lot of the 30s and whatnot with other members of the Corvidae, ravens and crows. And so, I mean, he's like 40 years ahead of anybody else on this. But all of his data on that was lost when his university was firebombed in the war, and so it all burned. So he did publish a little bit on it, but he was having to reconstruct things from memory. So rather tragic for poor old Kohler there. Anyways, the transposition task. The question is, can a relational rule be transferred to a new stimulus set? If so, then you've got a relational rule. So in training, we could present a gray square and a black square. We'll make the gray square the S plus and the black square the S minus. Then we present in testing two gray squares. The question is, which is the subject going to pick? Which will it respond to? Now, it turns out that the S plus is this same square over here. Okay, they're actually identical. I just copied and pasted them, slid them crossed a little bit. So there you go. Now, if your subjects respond to this one, they'll be using a relational rule. They have transferred, right? In that case, it's like they learned, peck at the lighter one. This one is lighter in color than black, peck lighter. Well, this stimulus here is a new stimulus. This was actually the S plus. If they peck the lighter one, they've learned a relational rule. If instead they peck at the S plus from training, then they've used an absolute rule. It's not peck lighter, it's must peck this particular shade of gray. There it is. I'm responding. Okay? Now, as it turns out, chickens and pigeons and rats and people can use both absolute and relational rules. They tend to do, we'll get to that in a moment. So they can do both here. Okay. Here's another way of doing it. If you don't like, colors, Gonzalez, Gentry, and Bitterman in 54 worked with chimpanzees. They gave chimpanzees, they cut squares of different surface area out of plywood, and they'd like give these like sort of puzzle pieces kind of things to the chimps to slide around on the tabletop and whatnot. No bad chimp, stop chewing it. Take it out of the mouth, that sort of thing. Put it back on the table. And if the chimps, they say, which one do you want? Which one? Which one? Which one do you want? I mean, the chimps probably don't understand the language. It's just like, goes to the human. But if they pick up the middle one and go, I want this one, they get a grape. Okay? So it doesn't take long before in training the chimps are picking the one that's got a surface area of 4. Just in my example, right? They use different surfaces. But picking the middle, the intermediate of the 4 squares. And they'd use different surface areas with different chimps and whatnot just to see if they could always figure out it's the middle in size. Then the transfer test. Now, so the middle one over here, surface area is 4 in training. Well, here it is over here. But we've also got, we got our 9 again. We've also got a 7 is tossed in. Now, if the chimps pick the 4, they've done absolute. They pick the 7. Well, it's got a surface area of 7. They've picked the middle. Okay? They prefer the intermediate size. And you go, wait a minute, does that mean the chimps can only do relational training? It's like, no, they can do absolute as well. It's just, in this case, remember I said they give them the 3 different size squares, they're going to play around with them on the tabletop, slide them around, whatnot. So they give them all at once. It turns out, whether or not you use an absolute or a relational rule, is very dependent upon whether or not you are trained in using simultaneous discrimination or successive discrimination. In simultaneous, you get your S plus and your S minus presented at the same time. So here are the intermediate size, right? All three of these are given at once. In this case, here's our S plus, and the one's got a surface area of 1 and the surface area of 9. Those are the S minuses. You got them all at once. It's really easy to get a sense of the relationship there when they're all sitting on the table in front of you. Successive discrimination training, you present them one at a time. So it's like, here's one, it's gone. Here's another one, it's gone. Here's the third one, it's gone. Which one do you want? First, this one, or this one? Okay? And you do it in random order, so the intermediate one doesn't always show up second, right? You know. In that case, it's a little bit harder to learn, but in that case, it's hard to make a comparison. It's like, which was bigger? Which was smaller? It's easier to go, okay, that one sort of seems to be exactly about this big. That one's big. Okay, that big, exactly. Okay, so in that case, if you've got successive discrimination, much more likely to learn absolute components about your stimulus. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
If you did these in different colors, you've now got a confound, right? Because now the question is, well, maybe, you know, you're trying to get them to learn the intermediate, but they really like red, which is always an S minus. And so why make it more difficult for yourself? It's sort of it in testing. You could do that. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, all it does is confound the study, right? And then you're trying to pick along two stimulus dimensions. So I need to pick the intermediate red one, but I really, I need to pick the intermediate one that's blue, but I really like the big one that's red. I really like red. Okay, so all that does is make it potential. I mean, maybe they don't care. You know? Maybe they wouldn't use it at all. Maybe they either use the color or something. But in that case, if you made them different colors as well, you have a hard time testing intermediate size because, so we got blue, red, and green. Which is intermediate? What's the intermediate color? No. So you could, but in terms of this, there's no reason why you'd really want to do that. Okay. So So relational control more often acquired if you've got simultaneous presentation and absolute with successive. Okay. Stimulus equivalence training occurs when we're trying to get subjects to treat different stimuli. Been a long day. Different stimuli or dissimilar stimuli as the same, as similar. So it's like, here's a bunch of really different stuff. We want you to generalize. We want you to treat them all the same. Okay? This is broadly called, and cognitive psychologists would call this, categorization learning. Okay, so this is about learning sets of things. You know, which of these things are the same? Which of these things are different? Okay, put them together in sets. Group things in related groups. Herstein, Loveland, and Cable in 76 did a now classic study on this with pigeons. There's a presence-absence issue with respect to pictures. If you pick the S plus, the S plus is an item for or is a stimulus for which an item is present. The S minus is an item for a stimulus for which the item is absent. And if you pick the S plus, you get reinforced. If you pick the S minus, you get nothing. Herstein and colleagues worked with various different S plus stimuli: waters, trees, and people. So in the water present, water absent case, if you see a picture that's got water and you respond, you get reinforced. If you see a picture that does not have water and you respond, you do not get reinforced. To give you an idea here, here's some of the pictures. Herstein just sent his grad students out with cameras and said, go take pictures. Now you, get me pictures of water. You, get me pictures without water. So, I don't know what the devil this is. It looks like maybe like loaves of bread or something lying on the ground. It's like, great, out back of the cafeteria at university, you know, a tennis court, like some standing water in the grass where it's flooded or something, a little lake shore. Okay, so, you know, stimuli for water as the S-plus condition. If you respond to either of those, you get reinforced. If you respond on these, you do not get reinforced. Okay, pretty straightforward. And he did trees, water, and people. And sure enough, you know, what they do is they give the pigeons pictures, 40 pictures with the S-plus and 40 pictures without for training. And then they show them another 40 pictures with, different 40 pictures with the stimulus and different 40 pictures without for their generalization testing. And the dotted lines show responding to the S-minus, the solid bars, or the flat solid lines show responding to the S-plus. And regardless of whether or not they're using trees as the S-plus, water, or people, we're getting a pretty good, you know, different pigeons are a little bit different here. But the pigeons are able, like this one here is really good at telling the difference between trees and no trees. Okay. This one has a harder time telling, you know, people and no people. Okay. But they're able to make this discrimination. And so what's happening here is you're not having to learn about a specific tree. You're having to learn all trees or, you know, whoops, where's the water? It's like, that's some water, and this is water too. So wait, you want me to respond if I see a lake? No, not a lake. Just any sort of water, because here's like, I don't know, just swamp. Or here's some water in the grass that hasn't drained away. Who knows what this is? You know, it's just water. So you got to just figure it out that way. Don't treat them as separate. No, it's not a lake, and that's not some water in the grass. It's just all water. It's like, this isn't, you know, Herbstein, the person. This isn't grad student number six, the person. They're just all people. Okay? So, in that case, stimulus equivalence. Okay. And we are out of time today, tragically. So we'll stop at this point and see you next class.